Welcome to the Health Edge. I am Dr. Mark Pettis. Great to be with you. Happy 2024. With a new year upon us, I wanted to launch what will be a series of presentations that will provide a cohesive overview of a systems biology or integrative health perspective on the science of health, the science of aging, the science of longevity and quality of life, what is referred to as health span. And I wanted to start this series by giving you an overview of what I believe to be the two greatest, certainly not only, but two of the greatest drivers of chronic complex disease. I think, as many of you know, life expectancy has increased significantly since the turn of the 20th century. And I believe much of that change can be explained by public health measures, sanitation. Certainly, the efforts to reduce smoking, which has been ongoing efforts from a public health perspective. And while humans and certainly Americans can expect to live longer, at the turn of the 20th century, average life expectancy was probably in the late 40s for men and women. And that is now into the late 70s. But I think, as most of us know, living longer does not always mean living better. And in fact, while we can expect a longer life than our ancestors did two, three, four generations ago, that longevity has been associated with a tremendous burden of chronic complex disease. So that the majority of us, as we get older, tend to be less healthy, tend to have a diminished quality of life, tend to lose our functional capacity, the ability to do things that we enjoy doing. And this, I believe, to be a trajectory that can and has the potential to shift dramatically. And inflammation and insulin resistance, or high insulin levels, are two passports to accelerated aging. And so I just want to look at this at a very high level. And then in the subsequent topics that I'll share with you, I'll dive a bit more deeply into inflammation, common causes, and what one can do to reconcile those drivers. We'll look at insulin resistance, weight, metabolism. All of these tend to be tightly connected. And so I'm going to share my screen here with you and start with a graphic that I had developed some years back that I think depicts a somewhat different way of thinking about the drivers of health. You know, how do we create health? Health doesn't just happen, it has to be created. And how do we do all that we can to manage the cards we've been dealt in life in a way that can better assure our longevity and health span or quality of life? And so let's look at this relationship at a very high level. If humans were a plant, for example, and this is a graphic that I would suggest is a more of a systems approach. It is based on the inherent understanding that humans are an integrated biologic system. So I'm an academic nephrologist by training, and much of my specialty involved looking at things that affected the kidneys, things that created hypertension, particularly difficult to control hypertension, And I was trained essentially to look at kidney diseases through the lens of hypertension and diabetes and things that are commonly known to affect the kidneys. And I became very good at diagnosing what caused kidneys to begin to deteriorate. But nowhere in that paradigm that I was trained in, and this is true of all Western-trained allopathic clinicians, was there a greater depth of understanding or pursuit and what the causes of those things actually are. And so if a human being were a plant, and you go in to visit your doctor or you go into the emergency department, whatever your interaction is with the Western medical health enterprise, the goal is to establish a diagnosis. And most Western-trained physicians are pretty well trained to do this. So as a kidney specialist, it wasn't hard for me to eventually come up with a name that I could attach to the constellation of symptoms and diagnostics and biomarkers that individuals were presenting with. And they had lots of interesting names like diabetic nephropathy and hypertension and nephrosclerosis and glomerulonephritis and focal segmental glomerulonephritis and on and on that list went. And as impressive as those that language can be, most patients would follow up with a question of, well, so Dr. Mark or Dr. Pettis, you know, what where did these things come from? And for the most part, we are taught that these are genetic and likely inherited by mom or dad or both. And now this is manifesting as genetic predeterministic ways of thinking would suggest they should and will manifest. So attaching a disease diagnosis would be the equivalent of having a landscape architect look at your plant and look at the leaf and say, yeah, this is obesity. You have prediabetes, you have diabetes, you have hypertension, your cholesterol is high, right? You have heart disease, you have angina, you've got a stroke, you've got a TIA, you've got ALS, you've got Parkinson's, you've got Alzheimer's. Pick your disease diagnosis. And I'm not mitigating the importance of diagnosing a disease, but the diagnosis itself says very little, if anything, about what's actually going on. Most people want to know what is going on here. And if I have come off the rails at some point, what do I need to do to get back on track, to get back on the rails, and to begin to improve my quality of life, manage whatever diagnosis you are suggesting I have, and ultimately create an environment that will allow me to live longer and live well? So the current model is one that really focuses on what name can I give this pattern of how you are feeling and what your diagnostics are suggesting is going on. And I think, as most people know, that diagnosis generally would then lead to some pharmacologic intervention. And again, I'm not suggesting that this isn't an important way to think about health, but it is inherently limited. And by its own self-limiting boundaries can make it very hard for people to realize what's possible in their lives. And so much of my metamorphosis as a physician educator and in my own self-care has involved deconstructing paradigms like this, in an effort to understand that there are root causes that go beyond genetic predeterminism that explain what's going on in my life. And through that lens, through a systems biology lens, some might call this integrative medicine, some might call it lifestyle medicine, some might call it functional medicine. I think it gets a little bit confusing, but it really, these are models that attempt to look more deeply, ultimately, at the conditions of the soil. No landscape gardener, architect would ever diagnose what's going on based on the changes in the colors of the leaves of a plant without looking at the conditions of the soil. And in healthcare, we sometimes pay very little attention to the quality of the soil that the plant of life is ultimately growing in. So when you begin to look at the drivers of chronic complex disease, and I would consider these metabolic drivers, and these would be some of the top of a long list that has very much been affirmed in all disciplines of the health sciences. So there's really nothing that I'm sharing with you that is of a theoretical construct. There is very good scientific evidence linking these connections. And one sees them in different disciplines: cardiology, nephrology, endocrinology, psychiatry. And the reason you start to see the same trends in these different disciplines is because it's the same drivers that emerge in a systems biology approach, which is really not the approach that we currently have. So these are what I would consider to be a handful of core metabolic imbalances that I will be diving into more deeply in some future content that I will be sharing with you. And today, I just wanted to focus on two major drivers of what ultimately become disease diagnoses. And the two are high insulin levels. I think, as many of you know, insulin is a hormone that was discovered back in the 1920s and found to be predominantly a hormone essential to the metabolic health of the human, of the organism. And insulin, in its capacity, will take fuel that we consume, glucose or sugar being one that people are more commonly familiar with. And insulin allows that fuel to be taken up by the cell and then allows that fuel to be used in the metabolic processes of that cell. People that have high insulin levels, and this is an epidemic, we might call them pre-diabetic, right? We'll have a diagnosis for it. We might call them diabetic. And we know that about 50% of American adults would meet criteria for pre-diabetes or diabetes. The synonym for pre-diabetes and diabetes is high insulin. These are individuals whose insulin levels are much higher than what our biology is accustomed to seeing day in and day out. Now, the second driver on this short list is inflammation. And inflammation is a normal process that the human body has that is enabled in an effort to heal itself. So inflammation will occur after a wound, after and in response to an infection. Many of the COVID symptoms are manifestations of an angry, intense inflammatory response. And research is suggesting that people dealing with more chronic or long hauler COVID have ongoing inflammation. Like insulin, our immune systems are designed to turn on in response to a threat or injury and turn off and come down to a baseline homeostatic level once that threat is eliminated. In modern life, an ancient system designed to turn on and turn off. I eat a meal, my insulin levels go up. I digest that meal and I use that fuel for my metabolism. My insulin levels come down. I have a sprained ankle. My inflammation goes up. And as my connective tissue and soft tissue heals, my inflammation comes down. People with chronic complex diseases tend to have sustained high levels of insulin. They'll fluctuate, but they live in a much higher zone than what our biology was adapted for. In much the same way, our immune systems designed to come back down to a place of rest tend to be in overdrive most of the time. So these are normal responses of the human body, but they become maladapted because the ability to regulate becomes deranged, if you will. So we're realizing that most people with Alzheimer's that develop cancer, that have Parkinson's or ALS or diabetes or obesity, metabolic syndrome with hypertension and high cholesterol and triglycerides and low HDL have evidence of high insulin and high and sustained inflammatory states. And high insulin and inflammation will often start long, long before these diseases ultimately manifest. So, in the context of wellness or preventive medicine, or as I like to say, the creation of health, is based on the fundamental understanding that by the time a disease diagnosis is made, these drivers have been in place often for years and simply go unrecognized. Now, the drivers can be traced to what I would consider to be the root causes. This is where you start to get down to the level of the conditions of the soil. And for the human, that's not a plant, the conditions of the soil are really the lifestyle and the environments that you are in. All the way back to preconception, epigenetics is suggesting that the health choices and environments that our parents had before we were conceived will set the stage for what our biology is, what the default settings will be once conception has occurred. So that our health trajectory can have its start preconception. Now, when you look at root causes, the current understanding is suggesting that our environment and all of these are attributes of lifestyle choice and environment will influence our book of life, our DNA. I've talked a lot about this, what we call epigenetics. And it's the epigenetics in response to the quality of the environment, the choices that we are in, and how compatible they are with what our biology can best function in, determines whether these drivers, these core metabolic disruptors, begin to come into play. And the sooner that happens, and the longer that is sustained, the greater our risk will be for these chronic complex disease diagnosis. So a lot is happening before the leaves and stems start to look abnormal or unusual. And so, this combination of environment, our genes, and the epigenetics, and now the microbiome, this ecosystem of microorganisms, and again, I'll touch on more of this in the weeks and months ahead, is known to be really driven by every aspect of our life, your beliefs. If you're glass is half empty, and I'm not passing judgment here. There are many reasons why we might perceive our glass to be half empty. But if that is your default belief of the life that you embody and are experiencing, you are more likely to experience drivers of health that will reflect a glass half empty. If one is fearful to step outside, fearful of things like fat, fearful of relationships that perhaps aren't working well, those beliefs will make more likely that our biology will become derailed. Bruce Lipton, in his book, The Biology of Belief, talked a lot about this many years ago. So our beliefs, how we perceive the world, is critical. These are things, they're not just nebulous. Beliefs will affect your biology. And so whether it's forgiveness, whether it's love, whether it's fear, whether it's hope, whether it's generosity, all of those attributes of one's belief systems are very, very powerful. Our beliefs, I believe, become the blueprints largely upon which our book of life is built and manifests. And we know that our beliefs will lead to emotions and patterns of thinking and behaviors, ultimately, as we know that so much of our longevity and quality of life is influenced ultimately by our behaviors. But our behaviors have drivers to them. One is much more likely to behave in a certain way if they're fearful of something than if they're not. If one thinks that a medicine they're being prescribed is really going to help them, they're more likely to have benefit from that medication. We call that the placebo effect. And so deeply rooted is that effect that you really can't do a good quality clinical study without including a placebo group, because we know that just believing in the effect of something will have a powerful effect. And the science connecting our beliefs and thoughts with changes at the level of DNA are amazing and remarkable. And so when one begins to look at the conditions of the soil, patterns of beliefs, feeling, thoughts, and ultimately behaviors, and these behaviors might be, you know, the food that we choose, how we move, how we interpret in response to stress in our lives, the burden of environmental toxins. We are all modern humans, canaries in the coal mine. We are exposed to more chemicals in our environment than any human has that preceded us. There's a price that we pay for that new to nature relationship. How we sleep, how socially connected we are, trauma in our lives. This is very pervasive. And while we can experience and do experience trauma throughout our lives, there's a lot of research looking at adverse childhood events. And these are very common and very under-recognized that, you know, in the moment and then in the months and years and the lifetime to follow, will have a metabolic distortion or disruption as a consequence of that trauma, more inflammation, insulin resistance leading to higher insulin levels. All of that makes obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, depression more likely. So one can begin to connect what's happening here with ultimately what is happening here. And again, how we manage conflict, mindsets of forgiveness, mindfulness, spirituality, meaning, purpose, in our work, love, and play, light quality, which I am very interested in that topic, circadian rhythms, social determinants of health, our education, our socioeconomics, childhood trauma. You know, these are things that in every moment, in every day, are driving our biology in a way that's keeping us on the tracks and moving smoothly or beginning to derail us. And that derailment might be subtle, It might be fatigue. It might be feeling sad. It might be starting to put on some weight. It might be having more pain. And then if that train not only derails but totally falls off the track, then we may find ourselves dealing with a more advanced chronic complex disease diagnosis. So this is a very different model than what I was taught in. And it's one where the diagnosis is important, but the diagnosis without any attention to the underlying metabolic drivers and ultimately where those drivers originate in terms of how compatible is our life, our choices, and our environments with that which is most optimal and desirable for our human biology. And the more disparity there is between the environment and choices that we are experiencing and have in our lives and that which is best for us, the more likely we are to begin to see poor health and diminished quality of life at a younger age. Now, epigenetics, as I've talked about, is, I think, one of the more transformative areas of research in human biology. I'm a clinician educator, but at heart, I'm a biologist. I really am very interested in how we work at the level of the cell, the tissue, and ultimately, this integrated being that we call the human being. And I was taught that most of what predetermines our longevity and quality of life is, in fact, our book of life, our DNA. And while certainly our book of life predisposes us to a trajectory of health or disease, we know that this book of life can be translated in an infinite number of ways based on the relationship between choices, environment, quality of our environment. All of those aspects of the conditions of one's soil ultimately determines which human will emerge from these relationships. Ours is a possibility of many different versions of ourselves. And the version that you see when you look in the mirror is not necessarily the version you were stuck with. And we've often been told or suggested that we are stuck with it. It's in our genes. We can't do much about that. You can change the mirror all you want, and the reflection will still be the same. Ultimately, we have to look at how we can change ourselves. And that's when the ref what is reflected back from us from that mirror begins to change. That is a much more dynamic and hopeful and proactive way to be thinking about health. Now, when you look at insulin and inflammation, and this is very strongly connected to weight, which is a problem for the overwhelming majority of kids and adults. And I'm going to go into much more detail in weeks and months ahead, but these are just sort of common themes, right? When you look at the conditions of the soil of someone who's got high insulin and high or revved up immune responses that aren't coming back down, you tend to see consumption of processed, these high glycemic, high sugar creating carbohydrates. These are as much as 50 to 60% of the standard American diet: flour, sugar, processed grains, wheat, even whole grain wheat. Wheat as a modern cultivar is, in my opinion, not for many compatible with human health. So this journey does require beginning to maybe question certain beliefs that you had about particular foods in this example and how they're impacting your health. And sometimes we have to really challenge our beliefs in an effort to come out in a place where we see things very differently. Certainly processed fats, vegetable oils, these hydrogenated fats, sedentary states, right? Unabating stress response. We all experience stress, but like our immune responses and like insulin and sugar, our fight flight is intended to turn on in response to a threat and to turn off very quickly. It was not designed to be on all the time. That is really what you see in chronic inflammation. You know, people who are lonely and socially isolated, you know, for the next generation, we'll be studying the effects of the pandemic and lockdowns. And we already know that loneliness and isolation is an epidemic. It's a silent epidemic for many who struggle in their ability to thrive in their lives. And that's every bit as important as the food that we eat, the ways that we move, and how we manage stress. And we know that people who are just sort of, you know, sleepwalking through life without much meaning or purpose, many toxins in our environment, these are all huge topics that I'll dive more deeply into. But things like mold, which is quite pervasive in our homes and office settings, poor quality light, not enough natural light, too much non-native artificial light, you know, the timing of our meals, all of these things are known to increase insulin and inflammation. These are the bad boys of accelerated aging, poor quality of life. They will disrupt the conditions of soil in your life in a way that will dramatically affect how your plant of life grows and flourishes. Now, this is from a research paper and work from Dr. David Ludwig, who's at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Ludwig is a pediatric endocrinologist, remarkable clinician, scientist, who challenged the obesity hypothesis that we get large simply because we eat more than we burn, right? It's caloric accounting, calories in, calories out, which I would suggest is a very significant and flawed way of thinking about insulin, obesity, inflammation. And this is research that I think is going to continue to evolve and hopefully transform the way we think about many of these issues. You know, one of the reasons I believe that we continue to get larger and sicker with every passing generation is because the beliefs and the paradigms around which we examine the drivers of those problems is fundamentally flawed. And if you don't change the way you think about what's driving these things, they continue to unfold. And that's exactly what's happened in our, when you look at the epidemiology and public health of Americans and people throughout the world. What Ludwig suggested is compared to the standard way of thinking that we get large because we eat too much and we move too little. That causes an excess of calories, and those excess of calories are stored as fat, and we get large as a consequence of that. What Ludwig suggested is that it's not so much the quantity of the calories that we consume. It is the quality of the calories. Food is information, is essentially what I believe Dr. Ludwig is saying. And the quality of the information of what we consume, independent of the quantity of calories and the hormonal effects of that information once we consume it, is really where the problem appears to lie. And so his insulin obesity hypothesis, and I think there's a growing amount of data to confirm this. These are still evolving concepts in medicine, but I think they're very exciting because in Dr. Ludwig's example, and I'm also follow very closely Robert Lustig's work at University of California, San Francisco. You know, these are, in my view, very superb clinician educators who've been challenging conventional paradigms and have a marvelous body of research to support the need to transform those paradigms. So Ludwig is basically saying that it's not so much the amount of calories, it's the quality of those calories. And in this example, carbohydrates and poor quality carbohydrates, these high glycemic flour, sugar, fructose-containing foods, ultimately are what drive fat storage, because they drive insulin. They also tend, the standard American diet is a very inflammatory diet. It tends to drive an overzealous immune response. And so here you've got insulin and inflammation, very high insulin levels. Insulin says store fat. You can't burn fat if your insulin levels are high. And so that's what happens. The high insulin levels, inflammation will take the fuel that you're eating. It'll store it as fat so that you have actually less circulating fuel to get throughout your body to meet your metabolic needs because you're putting it all into your fat savings account. None of it is being spent on the actual work of day-to-day biochemical need. And so the response to that, largely mediated through the brain, is to enhance hunger, which is why people who eat a lot of carbs are hungry all the time. That was my experience. You also will tend to do less because your brain perceives that you don't have enough fuel. It's all going directly to the storage of fat. It's a curse. And so the response is, geez, I don't want to be out exercising and burning more calories if I already don't have enough fuel circulating. So, the metabolic rate goes down, the opposite of what you want to be happening. Your desire to move goes down. So eating more and moving less is not so much the cause of obesity and diabetes and all that is associated with that, these chronic complex diseases. It is more of a consequence of the types of food we are eating, the information unleashed when we consume those foods. This is a very fundamentally different paradigm. And we know that one of the reasons it's so hard to burn fat, and I think most people in the health and wellness space know that, while activity is great, you can't outrun a bad diet. If insulin levels and inflammation are perpetually and continuously elevated, your metabolism continues to go in the direction of fat storage. You can't withdraw from that account. Now, this is a graphic that looks at insulin levels. And I would make the case that while 50% of Americans would fall into prediabetes or diabetes, that the numbers are actually much higher because those medical diagnoses are based on sugar levels. Prediabetes would be a fasting sugar between 100 and 125. Diabetes would be a fasting sugar greater than 125. Prediabetes would be a sugar after eating between 140 and 200. Diabetes would be a sugar greater than 200, for example, after eating. What I am suggesting to you, if you reflect back on that plant diagram, is that insulin levels will go up long before your blood sugar goes up. So far more people, I believe, have high insulin levels, but long before you see a change in sugar. In an effort to burn fat, those insulin levels have to come down. And once you get below a certain level, fat breakdown will occur. Suddenly, the security of your savings account for fat is undone, and those withdrawals can occur. And that requires going from a high insulin level to a very low insulin level. This is what you want. And while I'm talking about weight and metabolism in this example, if you go back to the graphic I shared with you initially, lowering insulin levels generally lowers inflammation. And that lowers one's risk for all chronic complex diseases, whether it's obesity, Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, autoimmunity, cancer, etc. Other research is suggesting and that when you look at the role of, that the microbiome is playing, and again, we have this incredible complex ecosystem of organisms in our mouths, in our gut. Those are the two places that tend to get the most research on our skin, of course. When you consume foods that are higher glycemic foods, foods that raise insulin levels, the biome in both the mouth and the gut tends to produce a metabolic output. This information, when processed by your biome, translates it in a very ominous and disturbing way. It promotes your immune response to become overzealous. It will disrupt your neurotransmitters. We might call that sadness or depression or anxiety. Your insulin resistance, you'll have a high sugar. You will be diagnosed with prediabetes, diabetes. Most people are going to be struggling with their weight, their metabolism, their mitochondria, their energy producing organelles are not functioning well. So they experience fatigue, they experience pain. Mitochondria are one of those top metabolic drivers. I'm focusing just on insulin and inflammation, but these are all interconnected. People with high insulin and chronic inflammation tend to have disrupted mitochondrial function. And whether you're talking about Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or ALS or depression or chronic pain, chronic fatigue, diabetes, obesity, you are looking in all of the life sciences at evidence pointing to disrupted mitochondrial function. And then lastly on this list, the stress response are this hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, this fight flight response can be perpetuated by the metabolic output that is generated from consumption of foods like this in relationship to the biome that we possess. In much the same way, one could look at, in this example, carbohydrates that are plant-based, most of which have a lower glycemic effect. Same calories, a gram of plant-based carbs has the same calories as a gram of sugar or flour, but they have very different metabolic outputs. And I think that's where the insulin obesity hypothesis of Dr. Ludwig is more interesting, and I think more accurate in that it gets you away from just the calorie. And looks much more at the metabolic output of that food, independent of the caloric intake. And here you see the opposite. The metabolic output from fermentation of organisms in the mouth and in the gut of more whole plant-based carbohydrates, has just the opposite. You tend to lower inflammation, you become more insulin sensitive, so your sugars drop, your insulin levels drop. That lowers cancer risk, lowers obesity risk, lowers the risk of most chronic complex diseases. And so this will be my last slide, but just to kind of summarize a little bit of what I've been talking about. In the example of poor quality carbohydrates, researchers have sometimes referred to these as acellular carbohydrate-dense foods. These are essentially grains. Most of the carbohydrate in the seed of a grain is not encased in a cell membrane. So it breaks down quickly, is absorbed quickly. Even whole grains, if you're looking at whole wheat or steel-cut oats, which I love, and if you're wearing a continuous glucose monitor, I think you'll be stunned at how high your sugar is at consuming some of these foods. But the point here is that these foods represent the predominant group of foods consumed in the standard American diet. They will cause insulin to go up. Insulin, as it goes up and stays up, will cause fat storage. This is your one-way street to storing most of what you consume in the form of fat. And when that fat is around the midline, abdominal fat, or what we call visceral fat, you will tend to be more inflamed. Now, the more insulin you make, as you make insulin with every meal, with every snack, this is just perpetually high. I would make the case that modern human insulin levels have never been higher than they are today. The more insulin that you produce, your cells say, "Oh man, I can't take it." Your cells adapt by making fewer receptors. They just can't stand the noise. So this is the cell's way of turning the volume down. I'm going to make fewer insulin receptors so that while all this insulin is circulating, I'm going to really turn down my response to it because I just can no longer stand the volume. That is insulin resistance, where the cell will now become more resistant to the effect of insulin. And all of this has the effect of sustaining, perpetuating, and sustaining chronically high insulin levels. Now, when you add additional causes of inflammation, unabated stress, chronically disrupted sleep, alterations of the biome in our gut and leaky gut. I'll talk more about these things down the road. Things that we talked about. These are the conditions of the soil that aren't compatible with what our human biology requires to thrive, right? To be healthy. What's optimal health? Health is the way that I think of it. It's realizing optimal vitality in the environment that you're in. Abundance is having the ability to do what you need to do when you need to do it. And I think most people desperately desire that. Part of it requires having more accurate information, more perhaps compassionate beliefs about what is truly possible. And that's when you begin to shift this dynamic. So all of these aspects, and this isn't a complete list, I'll talk more about inflammation in a separate presentation. But the more inflamed one is, the more active one's immune system is, the more resistant the cells become to insulin. So you've got this perfect storm of high sustained insulin levels, chronic inflammation, making the cells even more resistant to insulin, meaning those high levels will continue high. This is a virtual self-perpetuating cycle that is horrible, horrible. I mean, if somebody gave me a blank piece of paper and said, "Mark, what would your strategy be to more profoundly disrupt the health of humans everywhere?" It would be the standard American diet and a modern lifestyle in someone who is not aware of their ability or perhaps even of the need to be choosing more consciously, interpreting and responding in a more healthy and adaptable way. And this, I don't mean to suggest that those are easy things to do, but there's a big difference between saying something's genetically predetermined and these are the cards you have, good luck with that. Take this, take that, take this, take that. And the more you take, the more you take. And that's the current model. Very different than saying this is a malleable state that can be re-engineered, redesigned, sculpted in a way that can take your book of life and change the chapters to be written in a way that creates an entirely different, transformed human being, the new you, if you will. And all of this interferes with a hormone in our brain called leptin. Leptin tells us that we are satiated, that we can go out and move and feel comfortable, that we've got enough fuel to do so. Leptin does many other things in terms of mitochondrial function. And as we become resistant to leptin, it simply doesn't work the way it was intended to work. And all of this will lead us to eat more, do less, and we'll just keep that cycle of poor health and sustain it in a way that is just unforgiving. So I will pause there. And so just by way of summary, really the points that I wanted to make is that insulin and inflammation are huge metabolic drivers of all chronic complex diseases and quality of life. They are huge drivers of how long you live and what your health span or quality of life is along your life continuum. Most people confronting poor health will have evidence of high insulin, high inflammation, usually both, because again, these are interconnected variables. And while genetics will certainly influence much of that pattern, the conditions of the soil are largely driven by lifestyle, by environment. And so that is a much more promising and hopeful paradigm through which one can begin to better understand where are the opportunities greatest? How can I create better conditions of the soil that my plant of life is growing in? And I think most people, in my experience, and certainly in my own personal life and self-care journey, I've been, it takes my breath away when you begin to see how much things can change, how quickly they can change, and how many issues get better when you address the conditions of the soil because you're addressing root cause. So, not only might weight improve, but gee, my migraines are better. Gee, I have less pain. Gee, maybe I don't need the antidepressant that I'm on, and I can, with the right lifestyle roadmap, can taper off of that. Gee, I've got more energy. I just feel like doing more. So this is really the take-home points of what I wanted to share with you. It's based on a wide range of health sciences research, and I hope it's helpful. I'm going to spend more time in our next recording looking at inflammation specifically and what the common lifestyle drivers of inflammation are, some of which I set the stage for in what I shared with you. And I hope you're all off to a good 2024, and I wish you well. Stay positive, love yourself, and love abundantly, and get some natural light, get outside, hug someone you love, and I look forward to seeing you very soon. Take care, be well.